topic. Devotional service. And to help us make it a little less broad, Dwarkadish has narrowed it down to how to. How to experience devotion when practicing bhakti. Is that something like that? Something like that. Not just what the motions are, but how to experience devotion, right? Well, guess what? That's a topic of Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a whole chapter. I just happened to bring Canto 2 with me. And Canto 2, Chapter 3, Text 24. Canto 2, Chapter 3 is called Pure Devotional Service, Change of Heart. That's on topic, right? And the verse 24 from chapter 3 is about having a steel-framed heart. On topic. How to get on the other side of a steel-framed heart. So it's devotional service. So the verse is, I'll read the translation and purport, and we'll discuss. The person who has not at any time received the dust of the pure, of the feet of the Lord's pure devotee upon his head is certainly a dead body. And the person who has never experienced the aroma of the tulsi leaves, that's the wrong verse. Here we go. Text 24. Sorry. That's the previous verse. The person who has never experienced the aroma of tulsi leaves from the lotus feet of the Lord is also a dead body, although breathing. Certainly that heart is steel-framed, which, in spite of chanting the holy name of the Lord with concentration, does not change. The heart doesn't change. When ecstasy takes place, tears fill the eyes and the hairs stand on end. Okay, that's practicing devotional service. In ecstasy, purport by Srila Prabhupada, we should note with profit that the first three chapters of the second canto describe a gradual process of development of devotional service. Gradual development. So this is now a little summary of the first three chapters of Canto 2. In the first chapter, the first step in devotional service for God consciousness, by the process of hearing and chanting, has been stressed, and a gross conception of the personality of Godhead in his universal form for the beginners is recommended. By such a gross conception of God through the material manifestations of his energy, one is enabled to spiritualize the mind and the senses, and gradually concentrate the mind upon Lord Vishnu, that's chapter 2, the Supreme, who is present as the Super Soul in every heart and everywhere, in every atom of the material universe. That's chapters 1 and 2. The system of Pancha Upasana, recommending 5 mental attitudes for the common man, is also enacted for this purpose, namely, gradual development. Worship of the superior that may be in the form of fire, electricity, the sun, the mass of living beings, Lord Shiva, and at last, the impersonal super soul, the partial representation of Lord Vishnu. They are all nicely described in the second chapter. But in the third chapter, this one, further development is described after one has actually reached the stage of Vishnu worship or pure devotional service. And the mature stage of Vishnu worship is suggested herein in relation to the change of heart. Prabhupada uses this phrase, the change of heart, about seven times in the purport. It means it's important. The whole process of spiritual culture is aimed at changing the heart of the living being in the matter of his eternal relation with the Supreme Lord as subordinate servant, which is his eternal constitutional position. So, with the progress of devotional service, the reaction of change in the heart is exhibited by gradual detachment from the sense of material enjoyment, by a false sense of lording it over the world, and an increase in the attitude of rendering loving service to the Lord. Vidhi bhakti, or regulated devotional service by the limbs of the body, namely, the ears, the nose, the hands, and the legs, as already explained herein before, is now stressed herein in relation to the mind, which is the impetus for all activities of the limbs of the body. It is expected by all means that the discharging regulated devotional service, one must manifest the change of heart. If there is no such change, the heart must be considered steel-framed, for it is not melted even when there is chanting of the holy name of the Lord. We must always remember that hearing and chanting are the basic principles of discharging devotional duties. And if they are properly performed, there will follow the reactional ecstasy with signs of tears in the eyes and standing of hairs on the body. These are natural consequences and are the preliminary symptoms of the bhava stage. Which occurs before one reaches the perfectional stage of prema, love of Godhead. Paragraph. It's a long purport. If the reaction does not take place, even after continuous hearing and chanting of the holy name of the Lord, it may be considered to be due to offenses only. That is the opinion of the Sandarbha. The Sandarbha refers to Jiva Goswami's commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam called Sat Sandarbha. And in Bhakti Sandarbha, it details offenses against the holy name. The bhava stage is manifested by eight transcendental symptoms, namely inertness, perspiration, standing of hairs on end, failing of the voice, trembling, paleness of the body, tears in the eyes, and finally trance. The Nectar of Devotion, a summary study of Srila Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, explains those symptoms and vividly describes other transcendental symptoms, both in steady and accelerating manifestations. And then there's a paragraph about those that imitate those behaviors of ecstasy. And our acharyas don't speak highly of that. Then there's a paragraph with Lord Chaitanya's discussion with Ramananda Roy and describing the stage of bhakti when those symptoms of spontaneous devotion or ecstatic devotion are manifest. But prior to the bodily symptoms is the internal consciousness, and they're described as follows. Cessation of material desires, shanti. Utilization of every moment in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, avyartha kalatvam. Every moment utilized in service to the Lord. Eagerness for glorifying the Lord constantly. Namagane sada ruchi. Attraction for living in the land of the Lord. Pritishtad vasati stale. Complete detachment from material happiness, virakti, and pridelessness, mana shunyata. One who has developed all these transcendental qualities is really possessed of the bhava stage, as distinguished from the stone-hearted imitator or the mundane devotee. Final paragraph. The whole process is summarized as follows. The advanced devotee who chants the holy name of the Lord in a perfectly offenseless manner and is friendly to everyone can actually relish the transcendental taste of glorifying the Lord. And the result of such realization is reflected in the cessation of all material desires, etc., as mentioned above. The neophytes, that's us, by the way, due to their being in the lower stage of devotional service, are invariably envious, so much so that they invent their own ways and means of devotional regulations without following the acharyas. Hopefully that's not us. As such, even if they make a show of constantly chanting the holy name of the Lord, they cannot relish the transcendental taste of the holy name, therefore the show of tears in the eyes, trembling, perspiration, or unconsciousness, etc., is condemned. They can, however, get in touch with a pure devotee of the Lord and rectify their bad habits, otherwise they shall continue to be stone-hearted and unfit for any treatment. A complete progressive march on the return path home back to Godhead will depend on the instructions of the revealed scriptures directed by a realized devotee. End of purport. Very thorough presentation, although at the same time concise, of stages of bhakti from a preliminary stage that the first chapter of the second canto is, the first three chapters of the second canto is an answer, it's collectively they are an answer to two questions. When at the end of the first canto, Shukadeva Goswami appears on the scene. He appears in the 19th chapter of the first canto, where it's already, the stage is set, Maharaj Parikshit has been cursed to die, and he's renounced his royal attire, his crown, his palace, his title. He's preparing to meet his death because in 7 days he's going to be finished. The body is going to be finished. And he's invited, called for all the sages in his kingdom to come and advise him how to prepare himself for this moment of death. And into the assembly comes Shukadeva Goswami. And as soon as he enters, although none of the sages had even seen him before, they all rise. So just because this is etiquette in the presence of a saintly person, one rises to offer respect. And although he's just 16, and they're elderly sages, but they're respecting the fact that just by his presence they can tell that he's greatly advanced personality. So he's offered the seat of his father, Vyasasana, the seat of respect. Even his father is in the assembly, who sits at the feet of his son. And Narada Muni, who is the spiritual master of Vyas, sits at the seat of Shukadeva Goswami. And all of the other sages sit to hear this discussion. And the beginning of discussion is the king's submission to Shukadeva Goswami, and he asks him two questions. What is the duty of one who is about to die? Or for that matter, anyone in the kingdom, what is their primary duty? And the second is, what is that subject matter that one should hear, chant, and always remember? Shrotavya kirtitavyascha dhyayas nitya. One should always remember that, what is that subject matter? So that the first three chapters are starting with, we just heard the summary, the activity of hearing and chanting is mentioned in all three chapters. So that applies to anybody. Hearing and chanting, that's an activity. Hearing and chanting about Krishna. Gradually one needs to form a conception of the Supreme. Supposing somebody has no conception of the Supreme. So a beginning place for them is the universal form. And the way it's described in the first chapter is seeing that which you visually can see, perceive with your material vision, see those things in relation to the Supreme. The clouds are the hairs upon his head, the hairs on his body are the trees, the mountains are his stacks of bones, the rivers are his veins, the sun and the moon are his eyes, and so on. Seeing the physical manifestations in relation to something that you conceive of as God, that which is so great, these parts of the creation are manifestations of his universal form. Then the second chapter graduates from that, and in fact it says one can let go of that conception in favor of the conception of the Supreme who is situated within the heart of every living being. And there's a detailed description of the Paramatma, the feature of the Lord, what he looks like, but as he reveals himself to the yogi. And in that description, the process of hearing and chanting is again emphasized while fixing the mind upon the form of Vishnu, Supersoul. Then gradually, from the fixing of the mind upon Supersoul, comes this change of heart. But the verse 24 is towards the end, so there's many things that come in beginning. Prior to that, there's a strong emphasis in practicing devotional service to live very simply. You can say there are these two terms, pravritti and nivritti. I remember very clearly hearing these described by Srila Prabhupada many times. Pravritti. Pravritti is the path of material enjoyment. Many people, like most people, think that the purpose of religion is to help people become pious, and in that piety, to become enjoyers of the fruits of their piety. And after this life, promotion to the heavenly planets where they can enjoy even a higher platform of enjoyment. I've conducted this experiment about 4 or 5 times now in different audiences that I didn't know at all. So I just wanted to get a sense of where they were at, as they say. So I asked this question. The last time I did it was in Houston. It was a place that's very near the NASA project. So a lot of the people, you know, highly educated professionals, non-resident Indian professionals, PhDs and this and that and the other thing, doing highly scientific work. So I asked the following question. When I'm done, please raise your hand if you agree with the following statement. It's true. The purpose of religion is to live your life in a pious way so that by the mercy of God, in the course of your life, you can prosper from the fruits of prosperity, enjoy your life in a dignified, mode of goodness manner, respecting other living beings and nature and God, and prospering, and at the end of this life, attaining Svarga Loka. How many? Before I even finished, they all had their hands up. I said it, and Krishna says the same thing in Bhagavad Gita, that most people think that way. But you know what else Krishna says? Arjuna, don't think that way. Vishaya vinivartante viraharshadehinam rasovarjam rasokhyasya pram vishvadavartate. Just the opposite. For those who are embodied, it's very difficult to give up that concept of being the enjoyer. But one can not only give up the object of enjoyment, one can give up the mood of enjoyment by a spiritual happiness, by a higher taste, by happiness within. So in order to cultivate devotional service as grihasthas or sannyasis or brahmachari or whatever, especially it's appropriate for householders. There are a few householders here. One should follow this path of nivritti. So the pravritti is this: I do my work, my religious work, with the aim of increasing material involvement, increasing material prosperity, increasing material happiness, up to the heavenly level of material happiness. And that's the purpose of religion. That's pravritti. But there's another path, nivritti. And nivritti says, as I go along the path of spiritual life, I wish to increase my feelings of bhakti and devotion, real love for the Supreme, and my relationship with the Supreme. And in so doing, progressively, this detachment from all other things. Viraktir anyatra cha. Detachment from all other things is something that will naturally follow, and I may, in fact, cultivate simplicity in my lifestyle. Not Spartan austerity, necessarily, but simplicity. Keep things simple. If rather than this other tendency of accumulate, keep things simple and give one's maximum attention to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and one's devotion unto Him. So that's there in the third chapter. There's like all these, what's the need of pillows when you have your arms to lie on? somebody, you know, an emphasis upon simplicity and, you know, maybe a little bit radical, but in the direction of detachment from worldly enjoyment so as to increase, make space for, you know, mind space for attachment to the Supreme. We just observed the Srinath Chaturdasi, and if any of you read those nice prayers by Prahlad Maharaj to Lord Nrisingadev, it's filled with descriptions of the Nivritti. He casts himself as a wanton sense enjoyer. My heart is filled with material desires because I'm born in this Asuric family. I have no qualification. My spiritual conceptions, in principle, spiritual conceptions of life, spiritual conceptions of life become covers. You can't possibly carry a strong spiritual conception of life as long as there's material desire that really has a hold in your heart and carries you. Because as Prabhupada is saying here, the mind is that place from which activities of the senses arise. There's desire, and from desire comes activity. Thinking, feeling, willing, action. The functions of the mind are those three. Thinking, just like Krishna describes, by contemplating the objects of the senses, something happens. The mind becomes attached. Thinking, feeling, willing, then action. So preceding any action is something that takes place on the platform of the mind. So in any process of elevation, any system of yoga, what the mind does is very important. Again, the first three chapters, form a conception of God with whatever is easy for you. See things and see those things in relation to God. Then God is within. Higher conception. Factually, he's within. It's not imaginary. God is within the heart. And then when those feelings for the God within the heart accelerate or mature, then when the feelings towards the Supreme, by contemplating the Supreme, become mature, activity will follow. And then specifically prescribed activity, namely devotional service. So what's devotional service? One of the definitions of devotional service is it's very practical. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Bhakti uchate. It is said that bhakti is engaging the senses in activities in relation to the master of the senses. Such a simple definition. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Bhakti uchate. There's another part, though, that precedes that. That's the mental part. Sarva upadi vinir muktam tat paratvena nirmalam. Nirmalam. The purified state of mind where the upadis, the material conceptions of who I am, the designated conceptions, like, here's one, I'm a sannyasi and you may be a grahastha. Or I'm American and you're Indian. I'm man, you're a woman. This one is smart, that one is the opposite, not so smart. This one is beautiful, that one is ugly. This one is all those, you know, material designations, which has nothing to do with who we really are. It has something to do with who we aren't. The body has nothing to do with who we are. And to identify with those things that we aren't holds one to material contamination and material existence. So one has to let go of them. sarva upadi vinir muktam. They have to be let go of. Let go of the designations of material identification and then accept the spiritual position. This body which is not me, but it's still meant for service as awarded by Krishna, the human form of life, let me engage it in Krishna's service. Prabhupada liked very much to quote the verse about Maharaj Ambarish and how he achieved spiritual perfection. It starts with the mind. Sivaivanak Krishna Padara Vindayo Vachangsi Vaikuntha Gunana Varnana. So he engaged his speech, fixed his mind upon the Supreme Lord. He engages his speech in glorifying the Lord. He uses hands to cleanse the temple of the Lord. He uses legs to walk to the temple of the Lord. He uses eyes to see the beautiful deity form of the Lord. He used all of his faculties in service to the Lord. But it starts with mind, our dear most friend, or our greatest enemy. Take a pick. If the mind is controlled, it can be one's greatest friend. The mind is not controlled. Look out. So how do you bring the mind under control? The practice of bhakti, the vidhis, the regulations of bhakti, are to help one bring the mind to Krishna. Bring the mind to Krishna. Not just the behavior, and the mind is all over the place. Bring the mind to Krishna. And then as the mind becomes accustomed to go to Krishna, something starts to happen inside. Besides, more subtle than the mind, the deeper feelings in relation to Krishna begin to stir and awaken and mature. So, going again to the purport, I like this, these eight symptoms of spontaneous devotion for Krishna or Bhava. One of them is being very conscientious that every moment is used in Krishna's service, avyartha kalatvam. 1971, our head pujari at the Radha Govinda Mandir, just on the way over, was speaking about Mother Gauri. So the person who replaced Mother Gauri was Rukmini. And she joined the Hare Krishna movement when she was 17 or something like that. So by that time she was in a very mature age of something like 19. 19-year-old American girl, and pujari, and she wrote a letter to Prabhupada. I didn't see the letter, but I saw the reply. No, she was in anxiety that she wanted to use every moment in service to Krishna and Radha Govinda, serve them nicely. Because she's that kind of person. So Prabhupada wrote back, "It's very nice that you have attained the stage of bhava," which is one of the symptoms of which is one is very anxious to use every moment in Krishna's service. "Please continue in this way and very soon you'll attain the stage of prema bhakti." Prabhupada was very generous and liberal in his encouraging devotees. But one a symptom of advancing on the path of devotional service is one doesn't want to do other things. Viraktir. It's the detachment of other things. Other things, that which is not in relation to service of Krishna. It's not just Vidhi that says don't do it. It's, I have lost interest in that. And I think it's fair to say that probably everyone here, otherwise we wouldn't be here, has that experience. There are things that were part of our life, that not just because, you know, the scriptures tell you so, that, you know, there's this, the scriptures do tell us so many things, but, you know, some of the things we heed and some of the things we don't, even though the scripture tells us so. But so the beginning of devotion, there are certain things we just don't do because they're not sinful. But there's other things that kind of just fall away because I don't have attraction for that anymore. Remember one devotee specifically was telling me that their whole life is as an adult, they're from New York City. So once a month they would get together and spend, you know, the whole afternoon and evening doing what New Yorkers love to do, you know, like enjoying one of the finer arts of, you know, going to the opera or going to the Philharmonic or reading some nice, you know, description of something and discussing it because New Yorkers think they know everything. At least they know something about everything. So being well informed and, you know, cultured and speculators like anything about whatever's going on. And they did that, you know, as a regulative principle of their life. And when this devotee became involved in Krishna consciousness, they just lost interest in it. They didn't so much lose interest in the person. They just, the activity is, no thanks, I don't really want to do that anymore. I just don't have any. So we have all that experience, you know, the social thing. As you go along the path of devotional service, and there's all these people that expect these social things from you that you used to do and just don't have attraction to do them anymore. There's that space where it's, you know, I still have attraction to do them some more. But then there's the place where it's just, I don't have attraction anymore. But I don't want to offend anybody and hurt anybody's feelings. But it's just, I don't have attraction for that stuff anymore. It's a symptom of advancing. So prior to that spontaneous stage, there's a regulative stage where there's certain things that just, they're not, that they don't help one advance, and so I don't do them. And those things that help me advance, I do them. These are called symptoms of surrender. Anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam. Symptoms of, their limbs or angas of surrender to Krishna. Feeling oneself being maintained by the Supreme Lord. It's a symptom of surrender. Not like you don't go to work and Krishna, please maintain me. I'm this little baby, I have to be maintained. But the sense that it's not my work that's maintaining me, it's Krishna who's maintaining me. I'm serving Krishna, and Krishna's maintaining me. It's a whole other consciousness where one's heart is feeling surrender unto Krishna. Krishna is my protector. Krishna is my dearmost friend. And the sixth symptom is surrendering everything to the Supreme Lord, mind, body, words, everything, only for the service of the Supreme Lord. At least dedication like that. Wishing within one's heart to dedicate those things of my life, my body, my mind, my words. I wish to come to that stage where it's just for Krishna's service. That doesn't mean, you know, I wish for that day that I can retire and give up my job. It means even in the workplace or in the marketplace or in the, wherever I am, in the gatherings, let everything be simply dedicated unto Krishna's service. I'd like that stage to come. That hankering awakens deeper spiritual emotion. Now back to the hearing and chanting part. Hearing and chanting should be done with that aspiration also. That initially the aspiration is cleansing. Chaita dharpa namarjanam. Chanting should be done in such a way that one's heart becomes cleansed. But more, when you're hearing and chanting, you're associating with Krishna. Krishna's available, just like Dwarkadisha's question when we're chanting, what is Krishna doing? He's dancing on our tongue. Or when we're hearing, he's entering into our ear. And in the second canto of Bhagavatam, it describes he enters into the chamber of the heart. And he begins cleansing the heart and making the heart ready to receive him in his fullness. And further, the emotions. Krishna is stirring and churning those spiritual emotions within the heart of the devotee who is sincerely hearing. And the final thing that's mentioned several times in the purport is doing so, all this activity of devotional service, under the guidance of a spiritual master. The way that he says it in the final sentence of the purport, a complete progressive march. The second cry is always louder. That wasn't too bad. Okay. A complete progressive march on the return path home back to Godhead will depend upon the instructions of the revealed scriptures directed by a realized devotee. So devotional service means placing oneself under the care of someone who I have confidence in, that they will guide me on that path to Krishna. Not just theoretically, but practically guide me on that path to Krishna. And so I may not have the capacity to see or experience in a deeper way, but I'm confident the bhakti process will take me there, and here's a person who can guide me on that. And I accept that guidance, not just pick and choose, but I accept that guidance because of confidence and trust in that guidance and the guiding person, the process of bhakti itself. There's the process of bhakti unfolding. Then it becomes very progressive. And last point is this: the emphasis in the verse, the whole chapter, is pure devotional service. But, you know, very early in the second canto, strong emphasis on the holy name, naturally. That's our Yuga Dharma, chanting of the holy name. The broader is hearing topics about Krishna, and the very specific is the holy name, because within the holy name everything is there. So the Srimad Bhagavatam expands into 18,000 verses, glorification of Krishna and describing the process of bhakti itself, and the essence in its concise form is the chanting of the holy name. We need to combine both the chanting of the holy name along with hearing of the scriptures to guide our activity properly through the scriptures, but to purify the heart, the primary means is the chanting of the holy name. Put them together in a properly directed fashion, and one can advance on the path of devotional service nicely. Yes. Yeah, question time.
I have two questions.
I was just checking in with our host to make sure I covered what he wanted.
Yeah, two questions. One is more general and one is specific to this part of the Bhagavatam.
Okay. Take your pick.
I was just recently reading the same section in Bhagavatam, and I thought it was interesting about this universal form, how much it was emphasized. It made me wonder if, you know, like, as the Buddhists usually say, yeah, you have to meditate on the universal form until you get an affinity for the personal form. And then you kind of don't have to do that anymore.
That kind of don't have to do it, but explicitly it's rejected.
Yeah, but what made me think that maybe we're doing, you know, I thought maybe we're premature in doing that because the first verse of the second chapter says that Lord Brahma, when he was confused about the creation of the universe, he meditated on the Virat Rupa, and that pleased the Lord and gave him the ability to create this whole universe. So I was thinking that he didn't do that until after he heard the instructions from Krishna. You know, that, you know, he was confused and he did tapa and he got instructions from Krishna. So that second, first verse of the second chapter says that what he meditated on was the universal form. So it made me wonder, in the devotees, are we prematurely skipping over the universal form? Which kind of gives us a real sense of the greatness of Krishna, because if Lord Brahma himself...
Yeah, I got it. That's the third time around, I got it. Short answer is no. And a longer answer is, consider four persons that were neophyte. What did Prabhupada engage us in? This wasn't, you know, meditate on the universal form. Question. Was that premature? Answer. No. What if you didn't have Prabhupada's association? Answer. Follow his footsteps. Follow his example and his teachings. So question. Then why is it there? And even more specifically, Lord Brahma. I mean, if it's Lord Brahma, well, who are we in relation to Lord Brahma? And Lord Brahma meditated. So what about us? Answer. Lord Brahma had a very specific service. What was his service? Create the universe. So what did he do? Meditated on the universal form. It's described in scripture that he does that every morning. I mean, it's not all that he does every morning, but it's part of what he does every morning. Because he has to recreate, because there's a partial devastation during the night of Brahma. It's not like, oh, I forgot, what should I do now? It's just, he gets this impression because what he does just comes from his mind. Yes? It's just like, if you were Lord Brahma, I mean, if any one of us had the capacity of Lord Brahma, this place, this world would be a very, very dangerous place. And just by our thought, something would come into being. But we don't have that capacity. We don't have creating universe capacity either. So Brahma gets the impression. It's like the blueprint. It isn't like, you know, the whichever that profession is, the people that make the blueprints, and then, you know, the contractor takes the blueprint and he manifests the building from the blueprint, right? Something like that. So the blueprint, that's the universal form. It's subtle. And he assimilates that, and then he thinks those thoughts and bhavati, they come into being. He doesn't have to go, you know, tinkering in a factory to create, you know, the parts of the universe. That's, you know, we imitate that, those kinds of things. Make an airplane that's got, you know, aerodynamic, blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, it's all this uber karma. His is not. His is all subtle. So it's specific to Lord Brahma. Go ahead.
And then when I was thinking about it, I was thinking that Krishna does the same thing in the Gita. Like in the seventh chapter, it says, I'm going to explain how you can know me without doubt. And pretty soon he started explaining that you can see me in water and ability and then in the tenth chapter, he explains.
Those are opulences. Those vibhutis. Those are his vibhutis. And then what does he say? He's making it easier for someone that needs it easy. But that's not the, you know, the primary instruction. It's not the sadhana that Prabhupada engaged us in. Use your common sense, please.
No, but it just seems
you can keep saying but, and I'll keep saying use your common sense.
It's just hard for me to skip over those whole sections.
Don't skip it over. But where's it, where's it meant to take you?
To a deeper connection with Krishna.
It's to see the opulences of the Supreme and focus your attention upon the Supreme because you recognize he's Bhagavan. See the things of this world in relation to Bhagavan. Not just meditate on the universal form. It's different. Okay. I'm trying.
Because when you're saying you see the trees as his hair and his body, it's again like linking what's going on in this world to the Supreme.
That's different than the opulences, the vibhutis of the Supreme Lord. Help. In the first canto, chapter 3, Srimad Bhagavatam, one of the questions of the sages is, please describe those forms of the Lord as they appear in this world. One of those six questions. So the, you know, short list, not an exhaustive list of the avatars of the Lord as they descend in this world. At the end of that list, it mentions vibhutis, which is the same thing that you're referring to, the seventh chapter and the ninth chapter and the tenth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. They're opulences. But they're the opulence, vibhutis is not the same as Bhagavan. They're the material manifestations of the spiritual opulences of Bhagavan in the spiritual world. And it is he who is the possessor of those opulences. Is to see things in relation to God, which is different than first canto or second canto, chapter 1. It's seeing the form of the Lord. It's developing a very rudimentary conception of God is the form of the universe, which is different than seeing opulences in relation to the Supreme. I'm the strength of the strong, the prowess of all powerful men. I'm the intelligence of the intelligent. Those are vibhutis, which is different than the universal form. The universal form is chapter 11, and chapter 10 is opulences, vibhuti yoga. It's not the same. If you can't see it, don't. We'll meditate on it, see if you can see it in the course of time. What's your second question?
Second question, I had this a long time ago, and then I kind of forgot about it. Someone asked today in Srimad Bhagavatam class about this Srimad Bhagavatam that we had. Was it, the simple question, was it compiled by Vyasadeva? In the sense
yes.
that, like, he compiled the Bhagavatam, and he spoke it to Sri Vinayaka Swami.
He spoke, what he spoke to Shukadeva Goswami was the essence of the Bhagavatam. Yeah. You said it so fast that I'm not sure exactly what you said. You know, the chronology is what you're concerned about. So can you say it slower?
So he spoke.
Here's the sequence. He spoke the four. Shukadeva Goswami left the womb and left. According to Brahma Vaivarta Purana, there's another step. That is, he trained a hunter, a tribal person, to recite some verses. He went in the forest and recited some verses, and Shukadeva Goswami said, oh, that's so beautiful. tell me more. He said, no, I have to take you to the person who taught me. So he went, and Vyas then again instructed him thoroughly in the Bhagavatam. It's Brahma Vaivarta Purana. So, Shukadeva Goswami now has the entirety of Bhagavatam, and he spoke it. Now, when Vyas wrote it, is your question, before or after Shukadeva Goswami spoke the Bhagavatam? That question has been discussed in classes that I've been involved with from learned persons, and there's two answers that seem to emerge from that. It doesn't really matter, is one, because Vyas is Trikkalagya. So Vyas can write about something before it happens, and it's not a problem. Or he can write about it after it happens. And either way, you know, it's not less perfect if he writes about it before it happens, or writes about it after it happens. Because his instruction was in the fourth chapter, was going to be the beginning of the end of the sixth and the beginning of the seventh chapter of the first canto. He's instructed by Narada, meditate. Because he's already compiled the Vedas, yes? And then part of the Vedas includes Srimad Bhagavatam, the essence. But now expand it. Write one literature that expands it by meditation, fixing your mind upon the Supreme, and that which you realize, that should be the subject of this Srimad Bhagavatam. So, in one sense, he already wrote it. He compiled the Vedas. And then he expanded the Srimad Bhagavatam per the instruction of Narada. So, that makes it sound like, it said he already did it, but then he expanded again later. And where this fits in of Shukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Parikshit, etc., those events and the dialogue between them. And then later, Suta Goswami speaking, and did Vyas, you know, before, and, or in between, or after both of them. In learned circles that I've had this discussion, there's not a clear explanation given by our acharyas, that chronology, that at least we were aware of. And the second is, it doesn't really matter. Because he's Trikalagya. Yeah. He can write about things that haven't happened yet. He writes about what Kalki is going to do. Man, and details and details. Was history covered? Yeah.
It was just hard for me to end. I kind of said that same thing to my colleague this morning. It was hard for me when she said, well, then why is Vyasadeva calling himself a kind of the second show of himself in the great stage? You know, it seems funny that he's calling himself a great stage. And then he said, well, you know, if you're president, you can call himself president.
That's a separate question.
Well, you know, it was the same question, like, how did Vyasadeva wrote this? Why is he like,
whether he wrote it before? You know, whether he wrote it this point, or that point, he's the author, and he's writing, he's describing himself in the text as the great sage. He's a historian.
She was just saying the question, did Vyasadeva write this version?
Yes. Yes. But that's a separate question. The chronology is one question, and who's the author is another question. Vyasadeva is the author. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's what
then he's describing himself in that way. Let's not get stuck. Gorshak, do you want to add to this lively, stuck discussion? Okay, thanks. Yes?
Yeah. I had a very simple question. We are in Kalyu. Now, see, Narada Muni did exist before. I mean, according to what I've heard and learned, that he's always there. And I call him.
Always where?
Here in the world. Well, he was always in, if you go to any...
in the age of Kali, from the not just the age of Kali, but from the beginning of Brahma's day.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of yugas that have passed since the beginning of Brahma's day. Correct?
Yeah.
The number is 27. Yuga cycles. Well, 26, and during the end of the 27th yuga cycle in the life of Manu, a particular Manu, is when Krishna appears, right? And during each day of Brahma, how many Manus are there? There's 14. So there's a whole lot of time that Narada has existed, not just in this age of Kali.
Well, he did exist before. What I'm saying is, does he continue being existed? I call him as Krishna's ambassador. I mean, he's always there telling and explaining things about different...
Okay. Not always. By Narada's own words, not always. He explains to Vyas before this particular day of Brahma who he was, and it wasn't Narada, it wasn't that ambassador. He was a son of a Shudrani. You know that description, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, not always. He was something before he was Narada.
But the last part was he was not a Muni.
Since the beginning of the day of Brahma, we're stuck again. Since the beginning of the day of Brahma, he was Narada. Before the day of Brahma, it was night of Brahma. And he was within the body of Mahavishnu. And before the night of Brahma, he was somebody else during the previous day of Brahma.
My main question is, at this time in Kali Yuga, does Narada Muni is somewhere?
Yeah. In this Kali Yuga, yeah. But far, far back, beyond, before this one. But if your time frame is just this Kali Yuga, the answer is yes.
Yes. Because he has been always kind of instructor, ambassador, telling about some things.
Okay. Yes. Mercy is the most essential element, along with our effort, right?
Right, yeah, I understand.
Okay.
So what's the nature of mercy? Do I ever know that I got Krishna's and Guru's mercy? Because it seems when I look at the great personalities, they always pray for Krishna's mercy. Even though I think they got it, they are just great devotees.
That's right.
Still, they are feel very low, and they pray always for Krishna's mercy.
Yeah. So, when you become a great devotee, you can worry about, do you have it yet or not? Now you don't have to worry about it. You can just pray that, you know, I'm not very advanced, I need Krishna's mercy. But when will we know when we're there, we got Krishna's mercy, and we're just praying for it? When you become... there's a nice verse which I know you're familiar with. The symptoms of one who has received Krishna's mercy through the process of hearing and chanting is this bhaktir. What is it? Bhakti parishanu bhavo viraktir anyatra cha. You're familiar with that verse, right? When I start to say it, you'll remember. From the process of hearing, which is the essence of our devotional service, three things happen. Devotion, the activities of devotion will manifest just from hearing. And para isha anubhav is some feelings for the object of devotion, the Supreme, Paraisha, the Supreme Controller, and detachment from other things. just like by the eating process, three things happen. You're familiar. When you've been fasting for some time and you break the fast, the strength comes back to the body. The feeling of hunger becomes satiated. It becomes subsides. And one feels satisfied up to the point where no more thank you. Similarly, when one has received mercy, those symptoms will be there. An eagerness to engage in service. And some affinity with feeling for the object of devotional service. And detachment from other things.
So it's feeling, detachment?
An eagerness for devotional service. I want devotional service. I want to remain engaged in Krishna's service. And some feelings towards the object of devotion, Krishna. And detachment from other things.
And there's another question related also to mercy. Because sometimes it's obvious that Krishna's mercy. But I was wondering, because it depends how I look at it. I may say that's my karma, I may say that's Krishna's mercy. Or is it because I'm a
What is that?
That's a roach.
Music.
Okay, go ahead.
So because I'm a devotee, I try to see things as Krishna's mercy.
Yeah.
But on the other side, I may think my mind sometimes, it's just my karma. I would get, let's say I have a good husband, it's just my karma, I would get it anyway, if it's really Krishna's mercy. You know, my mind, you know, talks like this to me. Yeah. Because I see, I know it's, so is it like my perspective actually?
Yes. Bottom line, yes. I'll something that you may find helpful or interesting or useful. During the Memorial Weekend, we had a retreat in Giranagari, and the topic was the question you're asking. The topic was increasing the flow of Lord Chaitanya's mercy. So obviously, one of the definitions was what's mercy? What does it mean to receive mercy? And then, you know, refining. How do we know whether it's mercy or my and all those kinds of things? Mm-hmm. But just a short answer is, by consciousness, one will see things as Krishna's mercy. Because when you're in the internal potency, that is, in fact, what's going on. It's not just imagination. You're under the care of Krishna's internal potency. And what happens when you're under the care of the internal potency is it's Krishna's mercy.
I am not under internal potency.
When you're engaged in devotional service, that's the fact. Now comes your next question. What about when there's a mix? Right. Learning your wife's ways. Things. How can mine, you know, goes from this thing to that?
I'll quiz you later on.
Anyway, so it's proportion. The answer is the same as the other day we were discussing the same topic. Proportionate to one's surrender unto Krishna, we're under the care of the internal potency. So is there such a thing as mixed devotional service? Answer, yes. In what way is there a mix of devotional service? Answer, Kapila Dev gives that very nice explanation to Devahuti. Well, depending upon the mode of nature with which one is being influenced, there is devotional service in ignorance, devotional service in passion, devotional service in goodness, and unalloyed devotional service. So when it's unalloyed devotional service, it's unalloyed internal potency. But, you know, Krishna is accepting, even if we're in the mode of ignorance, engaging in devotional service, Krishna may, if it's offered with feeling of love, Krishna will accept our offering. Even to someone that really is, you know, influenced by ignorance or influenced by passion. Like Krishna, he's not obliged to, but if it's offered with love, he'll accept. So the key thing for yourself is the same answer that you offered before depends on our consciousness. And we'll see this is Krishna's mercy.
But certain, like, all these things are like, let's say it's my stupidity, because if I go outside and it's really cold and I put, you know, and I don't have enough clothes and I get cold, is it really Krishna's mercy?
No.
That's my stupidity.
That's your foolishness.
Right.
Exactly, Prabhupada's words. Not speaking of you, but, you know, speaking of devotee, some situation that was described to me that, you know, something was very, very poorly planned and poorly executed, and a devotee said, Krishna's mercy. And Prabhupada said, don't blame your foolishness on Krishna. That's not internal potency. That's your foolishness. Someone that hasn't raised their hand yet, just, you know, spread it around a little bit. You'll remember. You have a good memory. Yes.
I have a question about, try to ask it. When we're approaching Krishna, we say, Krishna, how can I please you most? At this point, what will please you most? And so how do you actually ask that and receive the answer from?
Well, one way is you ask your spiritual master. I mean, like the devotees, you know this story, the Atlanta get-together and all the Radha Damodar parties and Prabhupada will please you the most. And they expected he would say, distribute my books, because that's all that they were doing, distributing Prabhupada's books. That's not the answer he gave. Become Krishna conscious. Become a lover of Krishna. That will please me the most. It's not like they were disappointed. You didn't say distribute my books. And become Krishna conscious. Okay, then there's subsets of that. Okay, I'm not there yet. What's the thing that I should do to become Krishna conscious, because that will please you the most? So it gets back to the guidance of someone besides our own. We certainly can open our hearts to Krishna and offer prayers to Krishna. It's not like that's forbidden. That's part of the process of bhakti. But if we get some inspiration, or we're reading and we feel some inspiration from what we're reading, how to apply that, etc., is best under guidance. We should all be under the guidance of someone. Now, let's say, what about Prabhupada's disciples, that Prabhupada's not around to ask such questions? What's the next step, Prabhupada? What will please Krishna the most in my devotional service? So we all should be asking that in our relationship with Krishna, and we should be reading Prabhupada's books to receive that guidance from his our principal shiksha guru, whoever he may be, having as an initiating spiritual master. But then there should be some persons who are in whom we confide and take guidance from. I do that. Persons who I very much respect. And, you know, should I, what do you think, and take their input. Not, you know, take it or leave it kind of thing, but, you know, feel, Krishna, please speak through these individuals. I trust them, they're wise, they're my well-wishers, they know me, they know the situation, the field of activity, and still I have to make some choices. But, you know, not in a vacuum, not in my mind and Krishna, but guidance from wise personalities. wise and experienced personalities. Others? Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
You're on.
Well, talking about before when you said that he is ambassador, Narada Muni, he was rotating ambassador.
We're back to Narada Muni.
Huh?
We're back to Narada Muni.
Yeah. No, but there is very good story. I mean, something good that you may all enjoy it. One day, Sri Krishna Bhagavan was lying down and he all of a sudden started that I have pain in my stomach. And he was in pain for going up and down. And
okay, before you finish the story, where did you hear this from?
Ram Purana.
Huh?
Ram Purana.
His name is Ram.
That's very interesting. This.
Wait a minute. Do me a favor. If it's not from our acharyas, save it.
And it is from.
Where is it from?
Well, I don't remember that. You should know that I come from a Muslim country, so I don't know everything. So, but I'm trying.
I'm not worried about what country you come from. I'm worried about when you're speaking. Is it coming into cyclic succession, or is it coming from the ether? And if it's coming from the ether, if it's not coming from the cyclic succession, what should I do, Gaura Shakti? Just like say,
have you heard
let
of
me flatter you and just say whatever you like to say, and I don't feel good about doing that. Maybe I'm displeasing you to speak that way, but
have you heard of Krishna's? He was asking for charan dhuli of gopis, that he wanted to have the charan dhuli just from the feet of gopi.
Yes, yes.
So that is the story that I was.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Okay. So Krishna was having this thing that desire to do that, ask for that, but he pretended that he has got faith. And he comes, what is his name? That ambassador.
Narada
Muni comes. Narada Muni shows up. He says, "What is the problem, Sukhya Bhagavan?"
Yeah.
And he says, "That is the problem." He says, "Tell me, you are the one who created this problem that you are having. Now give me the medicine too. What is that will help you?" And he said, "Well, I want her bhumi from Vrindavan of the gopis' feet." So then, that's how they arranged that. So that's what I remembered.
Okay.
It was a very good thing, and also a duty of Narada Muni and how Krishna acted, it's a pastime thing.
Okay.
Is that good enough? I mean, that comes from our.
Not exactly, but okay. It's like in the ballpark.
Well, I should write it down.
What the Bhagavatam describes is Krishna just made a general declaration, and people were declining. Oh, we can't give dust. The cowherd boys were sent to get dust. And they went to this one, that one, the other one, and people were declining. Oh. Do you know what happens when you put dust on your feet on someone's head? You'll go to hell. Oh. They went to the gopis immediately. Take. So then the question was, do you know what's going to happen? Don't worry. Krishna has a headache. It wasn't a stomach ache, it was a headache.
Oh, it was a headache.
Yeah, headache. Krishna's got a headache. Immediately, take the dust, apply it on his head. We're not worried about the reaction. We don't want Krishna not to have a headache. Okay? Yeah, well, Prabhupada told the story. Prabhupada told the story. Bhagavatam? Prabhupada told the story. Okay?
This is for you, my ignorance, but there's so many phrases about to the lotus feet of spiritual master. What does it mean? How to understand the concept of the lotus feet? There's so much.
Sure.
It's like all over.
It's all over. I've never heard Prabhupada explain that, so I can't, like, immediately refer to some reference of Prabhupada explaining that.
Or, you know, when I read those things or recite or even Shri Guru Chanakama, what do I meditate on, actually?
Well, here's what I meditate on, that the Krishna is in Krishna Loka, and Krishna Loka is like a lotus, it's in the whirl of the lotus, and that's where Krishna is standing or residing, and the spiritual master is at the feet of Krishna. So if Krishna is standing upon a lotus, the spiritual master is at Krishna's lotus feet. So the feet of the spiritual master, the feet of Krishna, that's what I meditate on. The lotus feet of the spiritual master are the only way by which we can attain pure devotional service. So your question to me was, what do you meditate upon? I'm just sharing what I meditate upon.
I read somewhere that the lotus feet have symbolized the instructions of spiritual master. Is this a proper?
Any scripture? Curious out of anything that you recall hearing in your years of devotional service? Anything, any discussion that you were involved with and hearing on this topic, when we hear the lotus feet of the spiritual master, that means?
You're talking to me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They said
Giri Yadava. Ganga Mantri. I did say
Giri Yadava.
Ganga Mantri. My mistake.
I traveled with Giri Yadava when I was with my grandmother.
I did the same thing the other day with Gaura Shakti, excuse me.
That's all right, I just wanted to make
Ganga Mantri.
Nothing specific, I'm not just the idea of the lotus being above the water, the lotus, that's the general description of why we always talk about the lotus being above the water, even though the stem is down in the mud, but it's above the water, so the transcendental position is like the lotus, okay. In the Gita.
Yes, sure, sure.
You know, Krishna, he's supposed to meditate on his feet rather than go directly to his face. So that's how I was thinking. It's the same with the spiritual master, is the approach at the most humble position.
But why lotus?
Isn't it considered the most beautiful manifestation? The blue lotus or something is described as the most beautiful manifestation in the material world. It's above, it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's the main thing. It's above, it's transcendental. Using the metaphor of the lotus as above the surface of the water, so the disturbances of the material existence are not touching the lotus feet of the spiritual master, because they're transcendental, and that's the lowest part of his body, which is his feet, which are transcendental, what to speak of the rest. So it's a message of humble submission unto the transcendentally situated spiritual master, is what he's saying. Yes. Yeah.
Kind of like a venial position.
Sure.
Similar to the
description of Padma Purana, that the first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam represent the lotus feet of the literary form of the Lord. And specifically, therefore, with humble submission, lotus feet. Yeah. Still doesn't like do the yeah. lotus. The lotus part doesn't get answered. The feet part gets answered. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Let me thank you for the class.
He's just saying thanks.
Thank you. When we read the Srimad Bhagavatam, you see how Parikshit Maharaj is patiently sitting over the 7 days and asking some different questions. Sometimes in devotional life, that you feel like you get inspiration to do more, but at the same time you feel there's not so much strength, devotional strength, like to carry out everything, but you feel like frustrated that you're not able to do it. Like say, for example, I want to read this much, and you feel like I need to spend, but somehow by situations or because of weakness or not having enough devotional strength, you're not able to commit. So is there like lacking austerity on our part, or?
My thoughts were going to what to do about that, as opposed to why. Strength. One who is, if you're on the platform of devotional service of Rupa Goswami or Shukadev Goswami, then you know you can. Any vrata can be accomplished. There's nothing out of your reach. But for us, we don't have that capacity. So now what to do is take something that you can do and do it regularly. It's like introducing people to chanting. Do something you can do, do it regularly. And from doing it regularly, purification and strength will come and that vrata can be increased. We don't have sufficient strength because we're not so advanced. In fact, we're attached to things other than Krishna. This mixed position again. So I want, but it's not my capacity. So do that which is your capacity with regulation. Fixed. And watch it grow. Strive to make it grow, but grow with increments and not worry about what strength I don't have. Work with the strength that you do have and do it with regulation. Maintain it. And watch it grow. Let's have kirtan for a while. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada.